The way we take care of ourselves is ever evolving.
And what we know for sure is that our mind and spirit are linked to our physical body.
And that our wellness seems to extend into our communities and the planet we all share.
It is very, very clear that wellness is interconnected.
We love spending time with you to explore and practice the breakthroughs, the insights, and the passions of incredible people helping us all see the world in a whole new light.
This is HealthGig. Today on HealthGig, we have a very special guest, a person that Doro admires so very much.
We have the Reverend Dr. David Dwight, who is the co-founder and senior pastor at Hope Church in Richmond. But full disclosure, David is a lifelong friend of mine. Our families grew up together in Maine, and I've known David for over 55 years, which you probably don't think I'm that old anyway. But Tricia and I have really been looking forward to having you on the podcast, David. So welcome to HealthGig.
Thank you. It's so fun to be here, Dara, particularly with our friendship, and feels like an honor to be on the podcast. And Tricia, really nice to be able to spend some time with you as well.
Let's just begin, because we want people to know a little bit about you before we dive into some important topics today. How did you get into Christian ministry? Tell us a little bit about that and your family.
Family, I'll just start with. I'm married to Elizabeth. We've been married coming up on 37 years. And we have two children, adult children. Laura is married and lives in California. And our son, Dave, is single, lives in Denver, Colorado. We just came back from a little bit of time with them out in the Palm Springs area of California. We had a great time with them. Fun to be together. Personally, I think for me, Daro, I grew up in a family that were members of an Episcopal church. I'm the youngest of the three kids. And so it's really interesting to talk to Jody, our mutual relationship, and remember childhood. It's really interesting thing to talk with your siblings. If you've never done it, it's fascinating to talk with a sibling and say, what do you remember about growing up in our home and our childhood? That's not really what our podcast is about, but it's a really interesting thing to do because we have different memories of it, different impressions of it for a lot of understandable reasons. What I would say is we went to church, but it didn't work for me. I didn't have any interest. It didn't connect for me. By the time I was old enough to really sort of articulate in some sort of meaningful way a sense of religious questioning, I would have said by the time I was probably 15 that I didn't believe in anything from a religious standpoint. By the time I was 17, I probably would have said I was an atheist, not an angry atheist, just a person who would say, if that works for you, that's great, but it doesn't work for me. I went off to college, and a handful of things happened in my life that got me thinking about life in a fresh season with a whole batch of new questions. I also met some guys who had a really vibrant and authentic Christian faith, and I was intrigued by that. And that started a whole new series of asking a lot of questions. Then I started reading the Bible. That's a big part of the story. It so happens that Billy Graham, who I know had a special friendship with your family, I went to the University of North Carolina. Billy Graham came and he spoke five nights in a row one week, and I went to hear him. Those talks were very meaningful for me. I would say after about 18 months of asking lots of questions, trying to understand religion in general, looking at other religions as well, I prayed this little simple prayer. And I think the prayer went something like this: God, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think I'm coming to believe that you're real. And if you are, I really want to know you. And that was really the beginning of a burgeoning personal faith, which after a couple steps coming out of college, I took a job with a bank and I was in banking for a few years, but I had developed this strong sense of a calling to Christian ministry. And so there are lots of little gaps in that story, but that's kind of the big picture of it. So after 3 years in banking, Elizabeth and I left our jobs. I mean, kind of really sold the farm and went off to seminary to pursue a Master's of Divinity degree. And that was the beginning of moving toward ministry in the church.
So Dora told me about what you were like when you were younger. She said, you're like a super tennis player, great athlete. Just had a fun life growing up, right? I mean, is that kind of how you saw it?
I think in general, that's true. You know, I think for most of us, unless you had a very unusual childhood, it's the world as we know it. So you sort of think, well, that's kind of normal life. You know, it's until you sort of go off to college or you start meeting people who had quite different backgrounds that you begin to see your own background in a sort of distinct light. I would say in general, we grew up in a happy, loving family, and I'm exceptionally grateful to my parents for all that they created in our family. It wasn't perfect, and we had our stuff, but I've come to see it. I sort of describe it as, I always say it this way in our church ministry, all families are dysfunctional to a certain degree because all human beings are dysfunctional to a certain degree. What you sort of hope is that you're in the normal range.
Right. That's so true. That is so true.
So you're like, we're dysfunctional, but I think our family was like dysfunctional in the normal range. And I hope people can hear what I mean by that. I mean, I say it with love and so much appreciation for my parents and family. In years of ministry now, of course, I've had many, many experiences with people who grew up in exceptionally difficult homes. So they were outside the normal range, and the trauma and the pain of that is intense. But that's how I would describe my sort of growing up family life, a generally happy family, generally happy childhood.
While the religious part of it, the going to church on Sundays, didn't seem to resonate with you, there must have been some seeds that were planted so that when you started hearing other people speak, like Billy Graham, something must have been there.
Oh, for sure. My parents were members of an Episcopal church. If listeners are acquainted with the Episcopal church, there are lots of prayers and litanies of worship services that come from the Book of Common Prayer. I think for some people, it's easy for those habits, those words, and those prayers to become rather rote. It's what we're used to. They just kind of roll off our tongues and we don't really think about them. And I would say that was sort of the case for me. Now that my faith is where it is now, I look back on the prayers in the prayer book, and the beauty and the depth and the articulation of them is just beautiful. I'm not ordained. Our church is a Presbyterian church. I'm not in the Episcopal church, but I have, you know, a prayer book from the Episcopal church, and I make use of the prayers because of how, I try to think of the wording, they're just sort of elegantly expressing a personal spiritual expression. Lots of that is very meaningful to me now. So your word, I think, Tricia, was, did they plant seeds? For sure they did.
And now what you've created in the church is an incredibly uplifting experience, right? I know I was able to come and experience a service, and it's just, I don't know, there's just so much love, so much energy, so much, which is different than what I know I experienced growing up in the Catholic Church. I think what you've created is pretty spectacular.
Well, thanks for saying that. When we started Hope Church, I started the church with a very close friend and colleague named Pete Boel. And we started in a partnership that continues to this day, and we're really grateful for that. That friendship and that sense of being in this challenging endeavor together has been remarkably helpful and rich. When we started Hope Church, we started it with a belief that people really are hungry for God if they can find a safe place to pursue that hunger. And I really believe this to this day. You know, there's a lot of statistics and studies of religion in America today and people leaving the church and so on. I really believe people are hungry for God. And I frequently find that people want to talk about God if they can do it in a way that doesn't feel threatening, that feels safe to them. Before I would say I was a Christian, sometimes I had religious conversations with people and they felt condemning or heavy-handed or sort of cornering. And, you know, I don't know anybody who likes that. But if people could just have an opportunity to talk about God and feel safe in doing that, I think people really, really want to do that. So one of the ways we describe what we'd like to do if we could in starting a church is, can we create a church where it's safe to bring questions? That's a safe place to be a human being, and where we can care about people and their whole story. When somebody walks in the doors of our church, and I try to encourage our staff and everybody in this direction, you know, let's say it's a guy in a red sweatshirt. I always say, you know, who walked in today is not a guy in a red sweatshirt. It's a human being who brought their whole life in here. their past, their hopes, their fears, their regrets, their sadness, maybe their wish for some do-overs. We all bring all of that. And if we can meet people at that level of kindness and care, lots of really beautiful stuff happens. That's been a little bit of the heart of what we have hoped to influence here.
Do you think if you didn't have that atheistic period in your life, that if you'd founded a church, it wouldn't have been like Hope Church is?
I think all of that is pretty integral to some of the culture of Hope Church, because I talk about it all the time. I mean, I say all the time, if you're here today and you're nervous about religion or Christianity, you've got questions, you're not sure you buy all of this, I'm so glad you're here, because I am a person who's wired just that way. It does probably frame a bit of the culture of our church. And also, to be comfortable, it's not a better or worse, it's just different. For some people who were, let's say, raised in a Christian environment and the church all their life, if somebody said, hey, I want to introduce you to John Doe and he's an atheist, they might sort of get like really nervous, like, oh my gosh, what are we supposed to talk about if we're going to sort of have a conversation that gets in and around religion or philosophy? And I feel really happy to talk to somebody like that. I feel like I beat the bushes really hard on religious questions. You know, is there a God? If so, what's God like? And what about other religions? And if God is good, why is there so much pain in the world? And if the Bible's true, how can it be true? And is it any different than other religious texts and all that sort of stuff? That's a long journey for me that I had to wade through. And I feel like a lot of those questions are common to a lot of really seeking people. So when you can kind of enter those questions with somebody with a sympathetic ear, and I think that's the key, because I think a lot of people who have questions, you know, they're sort of afraid to ask them because they're afraid they're going to get a bit of a beat down or a condemning response. And I always say, your questions are how your faith grows, so bring them on. It just creates one after another really fun engagements.
When we talk about health and well-being, and we talk about belonging to something, we know that people live longer, healthier lives when we belong to a community. Can you talk about that, about how maybe religion can integrate with health and well-being, and even Hope Church, how it really is a community, and I'm seen for who I am? Like you just talked about how you walk in, and I'm there with my story, with my whole everything. And it's not often that people can feel accepted for their whole being.
You could probably make two statements that sound opposite, but I think they're both true. And the two statements would be, you know, if you've traveled around a bit and you've seen different cultures and everything, you can say human beings are so different. You could say that. On the other hand, you could also say, you know what? Human beings, when you get down to the core of it, are the same. And I think both of those statements are true. I think at the core of it, a human being longs to be loved, longs to be known, longs for some level of affirmation and acceptance. I think that's true no matter what culture you're in, male or female, whatever your background or nationality. And so in that way, I think we're all very much the same. Cultures are very different. The way people see the world and interpret a lot of things is very different. But I think at root, we are deeply wired with a longing to be loved and to be known and to know. That's definitely part of the story. I think, as you're saying, Tricia, that there are a lot of studies that talk about the benefits from a health and well-being standpoint of relationships, of relational communities, relationships of mutual support, where we have ways that our lives are connected to a degree that we can encourage and sort of hold each other up. Religious communities have a meaningful way of being this for people. Of course, I'm more familiar with the church than I am any of the other, like, Jewish synagogue. I mean, I'm familiar with all of that, but I don't know the inner workings the way I do a church or a mosque, same idea. But these create religious communities where people can share their joy and their sadness and grief. Lots of studies talk about the benefits of that. A quick little story. Years ago, I was on a plane and I was flying from Denver back to Richmond. And I had been there for our denomination's national conference, and I was tired, and I got on the plane, and I tried to put my magazine screen up, you know, like, and the woman next to me I could tell she was chatty.
You probably can tell pretty quick, right? I mean, you work with a lot of people.
Well, there were one or two little forays that she made. And then I thought, David, you need to put your magazine down and you need to talk to this woman. So she said, is Denver your home or have you been visiting? I said, no, I've been visiting. I said, how about you? She said, no, I've been visiting too. I've been here for a health and healing conference. And I said, oh, wow. So she said, what were you here for? I said, I'm a minister in a church, and I was here for a conference for the churches in our denomination. And she just threw out there, she said, I used to go to church, but I don't go anymore. I said, why? Tell me more about that. Tell me why. I figured if she threw that out there, it was open question. So I said, tell me more about how those changes came about. She said, I grew up in the church, and it was just too heavy. It was too legalistic and too confining. And I sort of nodded, and I said, I can appreciate that. I said, can you tell me a little bit more? Like, was it a denominational church or something? And she told me about the denomination. And I said, I'm sorry you had that experience. So I said to her, you probably, with the background you're telling me, you've heard the phrase Jesus saves, right? You know, this is a bumper sticker and so on. She said, oh, yeah, definitely. I said, did you know that the Greek word saves in the Bible also means heals or makes whole, makes well, restores? She kind of like started leaning into my space over the armrest. She's like, what? I said, it's true. The Greek word that is used for salvation, Jesus saves, it's the same word for heals, makes whole, restores, reconciles. So you could just as well say Jesus heals, and you'd have the same concept in play. So she reaches down into her backpack and takes out a legal pad. She starts writing on the legal pad. She said, how come I've never heard this before? I don't know. But I said, it's a very significant idea in the Bible. We understand what Jesus saves means, but it's much fuller than that. It's a much fuller, more holistic understanding than a slotted kind of idea, for lack of a better way to say it, just Jesus saves. The biblical idea is that he makes us whole. He restores us. He reconciles us to our Creator, which is a big part, in my view, of well-being. If there's a God who made us and loves us, and I know some listeners, that might not be their worldview, but if there's a God who made us and loves us, wouldn't you want to know his love? If you ask that question to most people, they'll say, well, if there is a God who made us and loves us, of course I'd want to know. And that just sort of begins a conversation. So she started saying to me, where's your church? Can I come to your church? So I said, it sounds like both of us are really interested in healing. And she said, that's a really nice way to say it. So it was a very memorable conversation.
Good thing you put your magazine down.
Yeah, right. Or she was going to tear it down if you didn't.
Trish, I don't know you as well in terms of faith and so on. But Dara, I was thinking a little bit about, you know, this whole Jesus saves, Jesus heals idea. Isaiah chapter 53 is a very, very well-known chapter that is understood to be prophetic about Jesus and his sacrifice for us. You know, and it says things like, by his wounds we are healed. But Isaiah 53:4 says something really engaging to me when we're talking about health and well-being. It says, surely he took up our infirmities. He took our infirmities upon himself. Which is really fascinating. That was written 700 years before Jesus comes into the world. So here's Isaiah speaking these prophetic words about this Savior who will come one day. And it says, surely he takes up our infirmities. 700 years later, the word in Greek says, Jesus heals or makes us whole. The connection between those to me is, it's just one of those beautiful little gifts of faith that is meaningful. Good timing for all that with Holy Week and stuff like that.
So you went to seminary school. What do you study in seminary school? So that wisdom that you just had, did you learn that salvation meant that? And how does that change in your world as a seminary student or graduate to like now?
I don't think I learned that specific insight when I was in seminary. When you give sermons, I'll say I average maybe 40 weeks a year. And you're doing a lot of preparation for those sermons week in and week out. One of the beautiful gifts of being a minister is that your own faith grows so substantially in all the work that you do to prepare what you're going to be teaching people. So in seminary, to answer your question, the most familiar degree in seminaries for people that want to pursue ministry in the church, sort of the traditional clergy path, would be called a Master's of Divinity. And it will get into things like biblical studies, New Testament and Old Testament. You'll take the original biblical languages, which is Hebrew for the Old Testament and Greek for the New Testament. You'll get into church history. There are also usually courses in counseling and what we call pastoral care. You could say it's a generalist's degree to try to prepare you for the generalist work of being a minister. But most ministers, once you begin to put some years together in your ministry, certain aspects of life in your Christian faith become sort of emphasized. I think that's just a normal part of anybody who's a minister. And if you all can think of different ministers maybe you've known over the years, you could probably think, well, that person had a way of emphasizing this part of faith, and that person seemed to emphasize this. I think that's all kind of beautiful in the fact that God has made different leaders differently, and we bring different expressions to ministry in the church. Seminary is a big sort of mystery. You know, when Elizabeth and I were driving onto the campus for the first time, we stopped about 100 yards outside the main entrance, and I said, I don't know what this is going to be like, but I don't think I'm holy enough for this place. So, you know, are there going to be, you know, like angels singing on the doorpost? I don't know.
Can we talk about prayer? Because I think people struggle with prayer. They don't know how to pray. What does it mean? So talk about that.
Prayer, in its most general sense, it's a distinct effort to connect with God. I don't want to go too many layers into that, but I just was leading a talk recently in our church about this. And I said, if you're new at prayer, for most people, when we're adults, we're not used to being beginners at things. You know, we're used to being a beginner when we're a little kid. So, you know, you'd start tennis lessons when you're 5 years old and you're not very good at it, but you get better at it. But you're just used to that because you're a little kid and there's a lot of stuff you're learning in life. But for somebody who is maybe 40, 50 years old, we're not used to being a beginner. We kind of don't like it. Feels very awkward. And I always say to people, if they're, say, in their 40s or 50s and they're beginning to explore prayer, I say, pray as awkwardly as you can. Just say whatever you want to say. This is how you begin to learn. Don't worry about how it sounds. Don't try to make it sound like stained glass praying. Just pray. And I also think authenticity is a really important part of expression in prayer. Jesus famously said, you must come to me like a child. You know, kids just kind of say what's on their mind. It's fairly unfiltered. It's one of the things that makes them endearing to us. And it's also one of the things that, like, as adults, you couldn't communicate quite the same way a little kid could. So I always tell people, just communicate as awkwardly as you can. And if it's full of ums and ahs and things like, God, I'm not sure, God, what to say, but here's what I'm feeling. That level of authenticity, I think, is really meaningful. I think a lot of times people would be nervous to pray out loud, or particularly in the presence of other people, because they're nervous about how it would sound. But if you're with people who are helpers on the journey, they're just going to warmly encourage you as you pray. And I think I'm much more drawn to a person who is praying that sort of stammering authenticity than when it sounds like a really kind of whitewashed, religious-sounding presentation. You know, and then the other thing that we laugh a lot about is, let's say people are in a small group. Let's say it's a couple small group. There's a time for people just to pray if they would like to. A commentator who I appreciate says prayer to be authentic should be vertical, not horizontal. And what he means by that is, you know, you have the small group and a wife starts praying and she says, God, I just would love to pray for my husband that you would teach him to pick up his socks off the bedroom floor and that you would help him close the refrigerator door and not drink his milk out of the carton, you know? And that's like horizontal praying. Like, wait a minute, hold on. You need to have that conversation with your husband and not sort of use prayer as the manipulator. But I think prayer is an honest expression. And the longer we do this Christian life, I think the more our prayer begins to move from transaction to intimacy. You know, transaction is sort of, God, will you please do this? Will you help this? Will you solve this? And that's normal. But I think for people who maybe have now decades, I think there's a common trajectory where their praying is a little less that way and a little more, God, I just want to be in your presence. I want to experience your goodness and your love and be present to you. I had a conversation with someone a little while ago, and we were talking about a concern in their life. This person said, well, I meditate about it a lot. And I said, I appreciate that. I think that's meaningful. I said, do you ever pray about it? And he said, well, yeah, I meditate about it. And I said, well, I think praying is a little bit different. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, meditation can be contained within yourself. I think there's lots of value to meditation. But meditation can be contained, sort of internal reflection and centering, where prayer is lifting you outside of yourself. You're lifting your inner world outside to God as you know him. Something different is happening then when we pray. You're trying to take what's in you and lift it to God. And that's a little bit of a distinction, I think, with prayer and meditation.
What an amazing conversation that will be continued next week. We have so much more to cover with David Dwight.
Thank you to both of you. I really appreciate your having me.
Thank you for joining us on HealthGig. We loved having you with us. We hope you'll tune in again next week. In the meantime, be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast and follow us on healthgigpod.com. I'm Tricia.
And I'm Doro.
Be well.